So I'm introducing this morning's reading, which is not a reading as such. It's a clip off of YouTube, and I'm glad that we know each other pretty well already, because it's a bit of an interesting clip that I've picked this morning by way of introduction. It's by a comedian whose name is Louis C.K., and he's got quite a bit of vulgarity in his act, but the clip is one that I just couldn't resist, because it really ties in with what I'm trying to say this morning. And because I really believe that some of the really powerful theological preachy type stuff that gets done in our culture is often done by comedians. And it is often done in nightclubs and shows, and it often has swears in it because that's what people come out to hear. And that's okay. That's just a different style in a different context and different language. But the messages going underneath, when those messages are powerful, then I believe that they have a place with us and we have something to hear from them. But I did want to mention that to give you a heads up for vulgarity. I don't see any children in the room except mine, which I'm forcing to stay to run the PowerPoint, so that should be okay. I picked something from late-night TV, so the swears are actually bleeped out. But it's very interesting. The other reason I wanted to pick this clip is because it has gone so powerfully viral on YouTube. The response to it has been really positive, especially among younger people who are posting it and reclicking it. It's one of the most popular clips of one of the most popular modern comedians, which I find very interesting given the message that he's giving, which is not what you would typically associate with a spiritual message of that age group. So I thought you might find that interesting as well. So please bear with me through some of the language and enjoy this clip.
Some parents really struggle with, like, all the other kids have the terrible thing, so my kid has to... Yeah, let your kid go and be a better example to the kids. She doesn't, just because the other stupid kids have phones doesn't mean that, okay, well, my kid has to be stupid, otherwise she'll feel weird.
Right.
You know, I think these things are toxic. I don't think they, especially for kids. It's just this thing. It's bad. And right. they don't look at people when they talk to them, and they don't build the empathy. You know, kids are mean, and it's because they're trying it out. They look at a kid and they go, "You're fat." And then they see the kid's face scrunch up and they go, "Ooh, that doesn't feel good to make a person do that."
Right.
But they got to start with doing the mean thing. But when they write, "You're fat," then they just go, that was fun. I like that.
So, that tasted good.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is, you need to build an ability to just be yourself and not be doing something. That's what the phones are taking away.
Yes.
Is the ability to just sit there like this. That's being a person, right?
Yes.
No one can, you gotta check. Because, you know, underneath everything in your life, there's that thing, that empty, forever empty. You know what I'm talking about?
Just I know
that,
what you're talking
about. Knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're alone. You know, it's down there. And sometimes when things clear away, you're not watching it, you're in your car and you start going, "Oh no, here it comes that I am alone," like it starts to visit on you. You know, just the sadness.
Yes.
Life is tremendously sad just by being in it. And so you're driving, and then you go, that's why we text and drive. I look around, pretty much 100% of people driving are texting.
Yes.
And they're killing, everybody's murdering each other with their cars.
Yes.
But people are willing to risk taking a life and ruining their own because they don't want to be alone for a second because it's so hard. I was in my car one time, and a Bruce Springsteen song comes on. And it made me really sad. It's like Jungle. What was the one? Jungle song?
Jungle Land.
This one where he goes, and he sounds far away. And I heard it, and it gave me kind of like a fall back to school depression feeling. It made me really sad.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, I'm getting sad. I got to get the phone and write hi to like 50 people. And then, you know, somebody cool writes back, and then somebody not as cool writes after, and I'm like, fine, you. I'm not going to. I got somebody better.
Hey, how come you didn't answer my text?
Speaking of which, he wrote first. That's right. So, anyway, I started to get that sad feeling, and I was reaching for the phone. Then I said, "You know what? Don't. Just be sad. Just let the sadness just stand in the way of it, and let it hit you like a truck." And I let it come, and Bruce. And I just started to feel, oh my God. And I pulled over and I just cried like a bitch. I cried so much And it was beautiful. It was like this beautiful, it's just this, but sadness is poetic. You're lucky to live sad moments. And then I had happy feelings because when you let yourself feel sad,
yes,
your body has like antibodies. It has happiness that comes
rushing in
to meet the sadness. So I was grateful to feel sad, and then I met it with true, profound happiness. It was such a trip, you know, and the thing is, because we don't want that first bit of sad,
yeah,
we push it away with like a little phone third for the food, and you get a little kind of, you never feel completely sad or completely happy. You
right.
just feel kind of satisfied with your product.
Yes.
And then you die. So that's why I don't want to get a phone from my kids. That's what I'm saying.
So how was that clip? Did we survive that? Oh, good. Thank you for your indulgence around the language there. In keeping with the TV theme, I'm now going to tell you about a cartoon that my kids have been watching. They're a huge fan of. And I have to tell you, I'm a pretty big fan of it myself, called Avatar. And it's not the movie with the blue people. This is a cartoon. And it chronicles over three seasons this child, he's 12 years old, who has to learn to master all of the elements and face the evil Fire Lord and triumph and restore balance to the world. This is his destiny. But what's neat is how it approaches this. It's not simple bam, kapow kind of thing. Towards the end of the series, as he's completing his training, the Avatar goes through this major moral crisis. He was a 12-year-old child raised by monks at the Air Temple, very Buddhist feel to his culture. And he goes through a major moral crisis because a peace-loving, meditating, vegetarian monk child doesn't know how to fulfill his responsibility to stop the evil Fire Lord in a way that's true to his values of compassion and nonviolence. And you watch the character really wrestle with this, which is not what you would normally see in a children's cartoon. And I love that. And I love how whenever the Avatar character gets lost or confused in this show, he'll sit down and he'll go into meditation, or he'll do his Tai Chi-like airbending exercises, or he'll pray to his ancestors, or stop to drink tea. At several points, he goes on these pilgrimages to get wisdom, seeking out specific gurus, or at one point, a turtle. And there's this one scene where the Avatar heads off to the Northern Air Temple to seek the wisdom of this guru who is going to help him overcome his attachment to worldly things, which is part of his spiritual progress. And after this long journey, Eastern Air Temple, Eric is whispering. Sorry, Eastern Air Temple, apparently. And after this long journey, he climbs up to seek the, and he comes up there and the guru is sitting there and he's meditating, and the Avatar climbs up and he sits beside him and they sit in their positions and the teacher starts sharing the wisdom gleaned from many years of meditation practice. And I'm looking at that, coming fresh out of a good chunk of ministry training, thinking, wow, we do it very differently in Unitarianism from this. And the cultural contrast is really sharp. We don't have gurus or shamans the same way that other religions do. We don't get our religious authority in that way from the years of spiritual discipline. And you could argue that we don't have religious authority at all in the typical ways. We do have clergy, as most of you know, but they're ordained by congregations, and that's a practice that basically says the people who lead us are the people that we choose to follow, which is different from the way it's often done in other Protestant religions. And our clergy aren't our religious leaders like a guru or a shaman would be. They're one type of religious leader with a certain kind of training that will help us do a certain thing, but we all lead one another. And we learn together what it means to be Unitarian, and if you want to use this language, we learn what it means to practice Unitarianism together. So I've got a question for you, learning together. What does it look like to practice Unitarianism? When it comes to those life moments, when Christians would kneel in prayer, Buddhists might enter into meditation, or an Aboriginal person might go on a long walk, what would a Unitarian do? So if the 12-year-old sat down beside you and said, I am new to being a Unitarian, I see you have practiced for many years, show me what Unitarians do, what would come next? I might hand him a book to read. It probably wouldn't even be a book written by a Unitarian. It was going to be about spiritual practice. I would say, well, I found this interesting from this religion, or this interesting from here. I might make a joke about Robert's Rules, or about spiritual practice being committee work, because we do invest a lot of time in committee work. Or I might ask him to tell me about his life and beliefs and his calling, and I might start from there, trying to work with him on a tour of what was important to him. So about a year ago, I started becoming interested in this idea of spiritual practice within a Unitarian context. And I became interested for a couple of reasons. The first is my own experience as a teenager. I had a very active prayer life as a teenager. I was a Christian, and I found that prayer piece really meaningful. It made a difference in my life. At this point, my theories about why it made a difference in my life have changed a lot. My beliefs have changed a lot. But there's no denying that I experienced having a spiritual practice as a profoundly good thing. The second reason for my interest is prevalence. It seems to me that spiritual practice has been present in some form all around the world and through human history. And I don't personally believe this is because God made it happen, because God wanted it to happen. It seems likely to me that there's some other good reason. And I suspect that it's because this stuff is good for people in some way. Otherwise, why would there be so much of it everywhere? There's prayer, and there's meditation, and yoga, and rituals of cleansing, and pilgrimage, and communion, and fasting, and mantras, sweat lodges, all these things in all these different cultures, but they seem to sort of share certain characteristics. There seems a quality that's a similar thread running through all of them. They seem to be translations of the same basic instinct prevalent in most people in most cultures, and something I think maybe is being a little starved in our culture, which might be part of the reason why that video was so took off and was reposted so many times on the internet. Something seems to be a little bit missing. The third reason for my interest in spiritual practice is simply the research coming out on it. There's a growing body of studies showing spiritual practice is good for our well-being. I think Unitarians have a unique role to fill in all this, because most types of spiritual practice come with a whole religion attached with beliefs and practices and rules that a lot of people struggle with, like many of us have struggled with. And more people are looking to find a spiritual practice that respects their freedom of religious thought. And I think there's a need there that Unitarians could fill. If we had a spiritual practice that we were offering. So that's why I started wrestling with, well, what do we have? What do we offer in that area? Instinctively, I headed outwards. I looked at what other religions do in that way that Unitarians have of drawing on sources from all over, thinking of our journey as an ecosystem, and what are other people doing? What are we doing? And comparing those things. Some people refer to that as practicing religion a la carte, but I think of that pulling from a variety of sources as wonderful. But implicit in that approach is the idea that our practice is something that I'm going to go out and find from outside and bring to us, from another religion or even another culture. So what is the Maasai spiritual practice? I asked my Maasai friend. When I want to learn about the perspective of other cultures, I often ask him, since the culture he grew up in, hunting and herding cows in rural Kenya, is about as far from my culture as I can find. Well, what do you mean, he asks. Well, we have prayer or worship or meditation. How do the Maasai reach for God, God-like stuff? I asked him. We don't do that kind of thing, he says. Whatever is there, it's there all the time. It doesn't come closer when you do this. There is no Maasai spiritual practice. Well, after traveling to his home in Maasai Mara, or where he came from, I'm not sure I agree with him. It's traditional for Maasai people, for example, when they make plans, to add a sentence that sort of translates to "if God wills it" at the end of the conversation. God is a pretty simplistic translation of that. It's essentially referring to a force beyond their control that may or may not allow whatever it is to happen. And when I ask my friend to define the being or forces, he frowns and says, well, how would we know? And that's as interesting as the conversation gets to him, and he wants to move on to something else. It's traditional also for people when they're walking and someone else is walking on the path, or they see someone else, to stop and offer greetings and have a fairly in-depth conversation that has different traditions. If you're older than me or younger than me, it would be a different hand gesture, or I might do this instead. But there's quite a few complexities in that kind of connecting. And they have wandering in the wilderness rituals and rituals around coming of age. There's ways to wash your face. There's certain ways to make tea. They have a lot of different practices. So I point this out to my friend, and he says, oh, no, no, that is not Maasai spiritual practice. That is Maasai living. They are not separate things. He says that a lot about all kinds of things. So he doesn't see the world as you work and you play and you exercise and you have your spiritual practice and you take care of your kids. That whole way of looking at living is very foreign to him. And so when I asked him to pick out what's the spiritual practice and tell me about it, it just made no sense to him. Trying to transplant a piece of Maasai spirituality by picking out one chunk of their lives and moving it over to our culture makes even less sense to him. And I wonder about the feasibility of pulling something like meditation or yoga the way we do out of its native setting and adopting it as a practice in Western society. When I think back on the active prayer life of my teenagerhood, I know it wasn't transplantable like that. Its roots ran deep. So when we transplant something like, say, yoga, I'm not sure it's the same thing when its context changes so completely. I imagine telling my friend that I want to adopt spiritual practice in my life, I know exactly what he would say. He would say, of course it is already there. You can't be living without spiritual practice. Well, that idea changed my search. I was thinking I would go out into the world like a gardener shopping for bedding plants, and I'd bring back the practices that I like, and I would transport them into the empty soil of my life. And in my friend's view, there's already a garden there. By default, if you're a person, there's a garden there, and it's alive and thriving, and I maybe just need to look at things a little differently. So instead of spiritual practice shopping, I ran a thought experiment where I imagined Unitarian life. I took for granted that it's already filled with this kind of depth and practice, and my task was to do a cultural exchange, to gain perspective by going out into the world and looking at my own life from a different angle, looking at the practices of others, using what I've learned to better understand my own garden. So I imagined visiting people and also bringing them back as guests. So perhaps you might start in ancient Japan. After a tour of a Buddhist temple, perhaps we're part of a tea ceremony. We see how there are certain traditional blends, certain serving dishes with deep history, prescribed etiquette, customs. There's great attention and reverence and silence integrated into the ceremony. And maybe we bring our guest back to our culture, and she asks, "Tell me about how you serve tea." Our family has a tea ritual that begins the day, although we wouldn't call it that. It's not exactly solemn. It usually involves arguments about sugar. My husband Gary has a coffee ritual separate from the sugar debate at the table. He wakes up, pours coffee, and then drinks it slowly over in the corner by the window, often staring into space and pondering. He says that's usually the time of day he asks himself what he's grateful for in his life. Gary draws on Stoicism for guidance in his spiritual life, and for Stoics, pausing is an extremely important part of living a healthy life. There are other tea rituals for other times. It's not just the beginning of the day. I will ask a visitor if they'd like a cup of tea or coffee, or I'll make tea for someone who's overwhelmed or sad. I still remember going to visit a couple whose son had just died. It was a family that has had experience with death and tragedy, and it was the second child that they had lost. And I was not experienced with any of this stuff, and I didn't know what I was doing. And when I first arrived, the father said, "Let me get you a cup of tea." And I said, "No, no, 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 no," thinking, "I don't want to ask for anything from you right now. You shouldn't be giving me anything. I'm here to give to you." And the mother put her hand on my arm and said, "Let the man make you a cup of tea." Because she was experienced with these things. She knew what was going on. And as I watched him fuss with the cream and the sugar and picking the blends and organizing the cups, I realized that, yeah, I needed to let him make me a cup of tea. Because in our culture, we don't have those defined rituals that follow a death. And over the 48 hours, we do this and then we do this. And that act of putting together the tea was something that he could do tangibly in a moment when we had no idea what to do next. It was important. He needed to make the tea. Even coffee hour. We often joke that coffee hour is the Unitarian version of communion. I'm not so sure that's a joke. I imagine our Japanese tourists watching us from the outside. We light a chalice, we sing, we talk, then we always go downstairs, and then we visit with each other. It's a statement about what we value, that consistency, and what we see as the point of a Sunday service. I know of a student minister who had designed this beautiful ritual to end a service. It was going to end on a somber, soft note, and she hated the idea of everybody marching downstairs and saying, "Oh, tell me, did your cat have kittens?" So she said, "What we're going to do is we're going to have a drum beat, and we're all going to march solemnly out. We're going to get in our cars, and we're going to drive home, and it's going to be beautiful." And the people said, "What?" And it was like she was ripping out the most central part of the service. If we had to pick between the solemn worship experience and the coffee hour, we were going to pick the coffee hour. That was the central piece. So I imagine bringing my Japanese friend and walking them through a service, and I would have no way of explaining why I think the coffee hour is part of our central not part of our central practice, and what we do up here is. It's not. It's all one big piece. And that chat says something. That is so central to us, says something about the connection that we share with one another being a critical part of our religious journey or our journey as a community. "Tell me about your pilgrimages," a Muslim might ask us. The journey to Mecca happens at least once in a Muslim's lifetime and is one of the five pillars of Islam. First, I might respond that we have no pilgrimages here, but then I might think a little harder. I might think about freeways clogged with commuters who travel these great distances, putting in all kinds of time in their cars, often cars, by the way, that are selected very specifically and carefully for the statement that they make about things that have nothing to do with driving. I might think of people traveling this distance in order to make certain statements to own certain kinds of houses in certain places. I might think of what we listen to on those drives or the function of that part of the day. Or I might think here in Saskatchewan of year-round cyclists in the province and what they say when they choose to integrate that form of transportation into their lives. I might think about how we design our cities and what we say about walking and cars and neighborhoods in our daily pilgrimage. Or if I want to think of great distances, I might think of airports in December and the idea of being home for the holidays. Or even if you don't make it home for the holidays, which is an idea that has meaning to most people in our culture, whether or not the holiday has a religious value. But if you're not someone who goes home for the holidays, when does a Westerner absolutely travel in our culture for a wedding or a death? So we do have these journeys that we simply must make. Now, within Unitarianism specifically, when I think of travel, I think of our fall and our spring gatherings, where we come together from across the country. And it's nothing like Mecca, of course. For one thing, the location moves around all the time, which is actually really interesting in and of itself. We come together every May long weekend, same date, from across the country, but where we go moves, which causes a lot of a logistical struggle, because you can't get into a groove planning a conference quite the same way when it moves all the time, and they try and have it go all four regions of the country in a cycle. And the reason they do that work, even though it's a lot more work to do it that way, is because of what it says about inclusiveness. They want everyone to have a gathering near them once every few years so that if you can't afford to travel, you have options. If you can't afford the time, people who are concerned about the environmental impact, a lot of effort is put into that rotation. And I think that says something really valuable about us, that we want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity in this huge country to have a gathering near them. "Tell me about your prayer," a friend from my adolescence might ask me, thinking about the way Christians use prayer to pause and reflect and to recenter on what's important and find strength or even connect with one another. I think of the way prayer requests go out in Christian churches, and I'm reminded of candles of joys and concerns. I think of the practice in my own home congregation, ending milestones by saying, "In our joy and our sorrow, we do not walk alone together." Candles of joy and concern matter to us a lot. They're not just a substitute for Facebook status updates. "Tell me about your monuments," an ancient Mayan might ask, thinking of the awe-inspiring temples that rise so high in the landscape that the tips seem to sit beside the sun in the sky. A medieval cathedral builder, hands dusty with mortar, might ask that same question. Where does God live for Unitarians? Well, if you ask a group of Unitarians where they feel the presence of God, you'll get a mix of answers. And a mix of levels of belief in God or even understanding what you mean by the question. But if you ask a group of Unitarians, even as I say, if you ask where God lives, there's a range of expressions on your faces. Some people are going, some people are going, some people are going. It's all different kinds of responses to that idea of where does God live? Does God live more here in this building than he does down the street? But if I say to you, if I ask you about the feeling you get when you walk out in the woods after the rain in the spring, everyone goes like this, because we all know that feeling. We all connect with that outdoors in some way. When I describe this feeling of spirituality to a Unitarian who says, I'm an atheist, I don't know what people mean. I'm not reactive to the term spirituality, I just don't understand what's being talked about. And I try to describe it, inevitably they'll say, well, that's how I feel when I'm outside. We all connect with that feeling of being outdoors. There's an astonishing rate of people telling experiences about being at the lake or gardening or in some way mucking around in the dirt or with the leaves and the trees, and you get that feeling somehow. So if Mayans built monuments to the impact of humans against an infinitely powerful planet, I see Unitarians putting great energy into preserving and protecting pockets of nature against a backdrop of, it seems like, infinite human structure and infinite human footprints. That's why our churches shut down in the summers here. We know that our cathedrals and monuments are things that are growing. It's that web of ecosystem out there. Wherever the ecosystem is thriving, you get that feeling. And not all of us would think about God's house or would empathize with the idea of God, but we know that feeling of walking in the forest. When we're gardening or canoeing or at the park, or whether we're going door to door with petitions on climate change. When I think of the two ways people interact with cathedrals, they invest time and energy in creating them, which I see us invest time and energy in preserving natural spaces, and they use them as expressions of what they value, or they spend time in them in order to get a certain sense of peace and comfort. A lot of us do that in the woods. But there's something else about that time outside. It seems like maybe when we're outside is the moment when we get to pause for a minute. Thinking now of what the comedian said about this is just being a person and how rarely in our culture we do that. And that seems like a common thread in prayer, meditation, tea rituals. So many spiritual practices involve that idea of pausing, stopping and just taking a minute in life. Unitarian minister Tendeka, when she teaches spiritual practice, instructs her students to go home and pause for a few minutes, several times over a weekend. That's the homework. And they come back and they talk about deep feelings of connection and feeling alive and being in the moment. They report profound experiences. And from this student feedback, Tendeka feels that depth that comes from regularly pausing in life is a critical part of being spiritually healthy and vibrant, and that it's something we have to offer ourselves and the world. And I've done this act of pausing. I did it a lot a few years ago, when I got a serious, but temporary and much better now, liver virus that attacked my liver, and I was quite ill for quite some time. I wasn't in pain, but I was very tired, and I couldn't move. So I just lay there being a person. And I watched the leaves change. I watched a leaf change color on the tree outside my window, and I don't mean I saw it green and then later I saw it yellow. I mean I watched it change color over the entire course of a day and saw how the yellow creeps up from the ends. And I found that really a profoundly changing experience. And when I talked about having that illness, it's hepatitis A, which is the temporary one you get from traveling, other people who had it quite seriously will come up to me and say, were you really happy when you were sick? Did you feel really at peace and connected? And I'll say, yeah. And there's this sort of, wow. And I think it's the pause. I think it's that you're not in pain, but you can't run around and you can't answer email and you just sit there. This is called being a person. And that changed me. I don't sit there pausing all day long anymore. But I do, in the same way you take time to take a deep breath or you take time to stretch a little after being at your computer, I'll take more pauses than I used to. And yeah, it has changed me. It's different from meditation. I'm a really bad meditator. I can't focus my mind on that. And whenever I try to adopt a practice of meditation, I kind of feel like I've gone shopping for bedding plants and I said, that looks pretty, and I try and transplant it into my life, and it somehow just doesn't thrive in that context. It might be the lack of regular attention. I have trouble with that kind of pause. I just end up, I'm accomplishing the pause rather than actually resting when I try and do it as a formal practice. I'm going to tell one final story about learning to preach, which was a bit of a struggle for me because I'm a fast thinker and I'm a fast talker, and I would preach really quick. And when I'm thinking about all the things you're supposed to think about stand tall and your breath should come from your belly and you want to talk up, chin up. And by the time I was done thinking about all that, I was just talking. And I had to learn to pause. So I would think, okay, pause. And I would add that in and I'd go, talk, 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 pause, talk, 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 talk. And that's not much of a pause. And so then I'd write, pause for 3 seconds. But 3 seconds feels like a really long time. And I was really struggling with this issue of pausing. One night I'm writing pause, slow down all over my sermons. And I think there was an old Simpsons episode playing in the background. There's one where this creature in a mad scientist creature living in an attic makes something called a pigeon rat. And I found that pigeon rat so funny when I was a kid, and I started writing pigeon rat in all the spots in the service because it's the right length of time, the word pigeon rat, if you say it in your head. So then when I was trying to say, now in this moment of sacred space, and if I put pause in there, it'd be, now in this moment of sacred space, I just pause. But if I put pigeon rat in there, it would be, now in this moment of pigeon rat, sacred space. It was perfect. It was just the right pause. So I got the timing just right, and I was so excited about this. And when my preaching teacher looked at this and saw the script with the pigeon rats written all over it, I said, but I paused for just the right amount of time. And she, after she was done laughing, said, that's not pausing, that's performing a pause. It's a totally different thing. So even if you're not moving for that amount of time, you're doing this. And now in this moment of sacred space, which is very different from actually pausing and looking at people. Performing a pause and taking a pause, not the same thing. No more pigeon rats, she said. And I think about that when I think about spiritual practice, that transplanting it over, sometimes we end up performing it, checking it off, unload the dishwasher, meditate, exercise for 20 minutes, instead of actually resting for a little bit. And it turns it into a conversation. And when you're talking to people preaching, it turns it into a conversation with the person, because you see their face change then. You see them lean in, you see them drift off, you see them smile or not smile. Instead of performing, it's a back and forth. And I feel like it's that way with spiritual practice too, that if we're performing a practice we've adopted and pulled in from somewhere, that's very different from a pause to let a practice grow and to see what happens in that space, providing the soil and the seed and the sunlight and seeing what happens instead of sticking a bedding plant that's been successful somewhere else right in there. So if I imagine the 12-year-old avatar child sitting beside me and asking me about Unitarian spiritual practice, I wouldn't have necessarily a plan of this is how we progress as Unitarians, but I think I would have a few things to say. One would be that for us, you need to make room for both sides of the conversation, and that refers to living, that you live and then you pause and take a breath, and you sit for a minute and then you live, and you're not always necessarily on the smartphone or running through a list, that you try and make a little bit of room in there for something to grow. But it also refers, especially with Unitarians, to a back-and-forth conversational approach to how we do community. So the things that are really central to us are things like the coffee hour and the candles of joys and concerns. Those are the spots where we talk to one another. That's the spot where we hear about the egg carton on the kitchen window. That matters. That's really important. It's not, practicing our religion isn't about coming and having something bestowed on you in a ceremony and going home. It's a conversation, and it's a conversation with life. And it's a conversation with nature, and it's a conversation with one another. And if you look at how we practice Unitarianism and say, if you were to bring it in a tourist and say, you know, what are our practices? They all seem to add up to this sort of statement about it's a conversation, it's a back and forth, an exploration, not a thing that's necessarily performed out the way Protestant religions sometimes, other religions that we come from, have done it. So we're deeply intentional people. We think about how we do things. We pause, but not all the time. We don't exist, just exist inside our lives, but we dive into them. We come up for air, we move around. And we are in intentional relationship with the world and with one another. As the comedian said, this is being a person. This is being alive. This is taking life as a series of moments.
You're taken away.
Yes.
Is the ability to just sit there. like this. That's being a person, right?
The moment was...
How would you define a moment?
I can't even say.
I don't know. Ask me something simple. A moment in normal time. Normal time is this.
What is a moment, though, honestly?
It's that thing. It's beyond the senses.
A moment. I don't know.